This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Puerto Rico has reported the first death from the Zika virus, an indicator that the mosquito population is moving north at a steady pace.
Mark, we should note that HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell went there last week to meet with our partner scientists on the ground. She was observing Puerto Rico's response to the arrival of Zika and the mosquito known to carry the virus. Their epidemiologists will be doing a lot to inform public officials here in the U.S. as we prepare for the arrival of Zika on these shores. And the clock is ticking as the season moves forward.
It really is, Margaret. And as we reported last week, Congress didn't approve the president's funding request for Zika preparedness here in the United States. So any relevant information we can gain from Puerto Rico's frontline experience, as well as other Latin American countries already grappling with the outbreak, will help us understand the depth of the threat to the population in this country. Zika exposure has been linked to some devastating birth defects.
And public health officials in the Gulf states are already galvanizing resources to get the word out about potential threats from Zika so that people can take extra precautions, and certainly particularly pregnant women. As we both know, Mark, funding underlies so much of what we can do in public health. And the funding of healthcare in America is at the very core of the work our guest today is responsible for. Dr. Patrick Conway is Deputy Administrator and Chief Medical Officer at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He also runs the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation. A very big job.
You're absolutely right. And I think he's being called the most powerful doctor in America. With a $1 trillion healthcare budget to oversee, and with these sweeping new guidelines on how Medicare providers will be paid for quality and outcomes, and we're really looking forward to hearing about the new rules aimed at transforming the American healthcare system.
Well, Lori Robertson will be checking in, as she does every week, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com, or you can email us at chcradio@chc1.com.
Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love to hear from you. So we will get to our interview with Dr. Patrick Conway in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Hundreds of scientific researchers and activists gathered in the Holy See to discuss ways to advance global research for cancer and other deadly diseases. Vice President Joe Biden, who is leading the president's Moonshot for Cancer, was joined by others toiling on the front lines of disease research. The gathering at the Vatican called Cellular Horizons was organized by the U.S.-based Stem for Life Foundation to share ideas and treatments on the use of adult stem cells to cure rare diseases. Vice President Biden saying cancer is an international problem and we are on the verge of major breakthroughs, but not enough is being done to coalesce that research. The Pope chided the global health industry to make sure cancer treatments are available to all, regardless of who can afford it, saying people must take precedence over profits. The vice president lost his son, Beau, to cancer last year. Speaking of profits, executives from the pharmaceutical company Valeant were in the hot seat in Congress defending the jacking up of prices of a number of commonly prescribed drugs. The Senate Special Committee on Aging, one of two U.S. congressional panels investigating the skyrocketing price increases of certain decades-old drugs acquired by companies including Valeant and Turing Pharmaceuticals, a company founded by Martin Shkreli. A major Valeant shareholder appeared Wednesday alongside the company's outgoing chief executive, Michael Pearson, and Howard Schiller, board member and former financial officer. Valeant has faced mounting scrutiny by members of Congress, prosecutors, and regulators over its drug pricing, business practices, and accounting. Valeant had hiked prices of some of their drugs by several thousand percent, the outgoing CEO saying he'll urge the company to drop those prices back down. And drugs on the black market, a counterfeit opioid produced in China, has hit the Pacific Northwest with a vengeance. The counterfeit version of fentanyl, 100 times more potent than morphine, has caused a spate of overdoses. Fentanyl is purchased from China, shipped to Mexico, and transported to the U.S. across its southwest border. The fentanyl is processed into counterfeit tablets that carry the markings of legitimate prescription medications, including hydrocodone drugs like Norco. In 2014 alone, there were 47,000 overdose deaths in this country, and those numbers from 2015 and beyond are expected to be much higher. Zika has gained a foothold in Puerto Rico, the American territory less than 1,000 miles from the Florida coast. One death reported, 65 pregnant women have been exposed. Health officials in Texas, meanwhile, are urging women who are pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant to be vigilant about mosquito protection. Public health officials, though, not going so far as to urge couples not to get pregnant. And pregnancy rates have been dropping steadily over the past several years among teens, including African-American and Hispanic teens, but also dropping over the past few years the number of teens receiving formal sex education. A study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health found that there was a 10% drop in formal health and sex ed classes over the past 10 years. In addition to the questions about birth control methods, the study asked teens whether they had received any formal instruction at their schools, churches, community centers, or elsewhere about sexually transmitted diseases or how to prevent HIV/AIDS. Again, that information lacking as well. I'm Mariette O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Patrick Conway, Acting Principal Deputy Administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid and CMS Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality, as well as CMS's Chief Medical Officer. He oversees access to care for the 100 million Americans receiving health coverage through Medicare and Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. A pediatric hospitalist, Dr. Conway served as Chief Medical Officer at the Department of Health and Human Services. He's received numerous distinctions, including the induction into the Institute of Medicine and the HHS Award for Distinguished Service. He earned his medical degree from Baylor College of Medicine, and he completed his pediatric residency at Harvard's Medical School's Children's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Conway, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you have the distinction of being called the most powerful doctor in America. And yet, as Chief Medical Officer of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, you manage a trillion-dollar care delivery system. And you're also at the helm of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation and key figure in guiding the transformation of the nation's healthcare system. But at heart, you're a clinician and you're still practicing medicine on the weekends. Congratulations. And I wonder if we could just start out thematically. What should our listeners be keeping an eye on around the crucial transformations that are going on?
Yeah. So first, not sure about the most powerful doctor in America, but yes.
That's good.
And, you know, been a great to serve the last, you know, 5+ years in this chief medical officer role. And then expanding roles, as you described. You know, on the high-level goals and what this means for patients and people across America, you know, we're focused on better care, smarter spending, and healthier people. And it really is a transformation that tries to put patients at the center of care delivery, have well-coordinated care, and the best possible patient outcomes. You know, to get there, we're trying to create change in three major areas. One is payment. You know, how do we pay for better outcomes and higher quality and not the volume of care delivered? So right now, our fee-for-service system, you know, pays for 15-minute office visits or surgeries in volume, but we're really trying to align it with what matters to patients and people, which is better outcomes and care coordination. Then two, we're focused on care delivery, integration of mental and behavioral health, and also prevention of disease, helping incentivize keeping people healthy and out of the hospital. And then the third area is information. So this is, you know, transparency through compare websites and star ratings and other systems around the quality and cost of care, and also electronic health information, both for patients and for providers. So, you know, I think the critical point over the last 5 years, I think we've seen significant transformation of the health system, but we got much more work to do to make sure we achieve the best health outcomes possible for people across the nation.
Well, Dr. Conway, you've certainly been able to observe this evolution of healthcare and health reform from within the federal bureaucracy for some time now. And you were first appointed by Michael Levitt as a White House fellow during the Bush administration. Dr. Berwick appointed you chief medical officer at CMS in 2010. And now you're presiding over a spate of new directives and regulations around how people in healthcare are paid, moving from that fee-for-service system to something else, how much they're paid, and for what. What are the big difficulties you face in changing how we pay for healthcare in this country, and why the changes are so essential?
Yeah, so first, just I've served in a Republican administration, now in a Democratic administration. I think delivery system reform and health system improvement, I think, is truly bipartisan. Yeah, the first challenge I would call out is really dealing with the diversity of medicine. So, in Medicare, we have to think about different specialties, rural providers, small practices, other diverse practice settings, but often are creating national programs and payments and policies. The way we've tried to address that is to have different options for people as they make this transition, different on-ramps, if you will, as people transition their practices, and really focus on supporting especially those small and rural practices and safety net providers. I think this burden issue and physician-clinician burnout is real. Mm-hmm. Both my own family members and, as I practice in the clinical setting, I think, we need to simplify whenever possible, lessen burden on physicians and clinicians, really try to align requirements across the public and private sector. And we've done work with private health plans to try to improve there. At the end of the day, focus on what matters most to clinicians and doctors and patients, which is better patient outcomes. So as we make this migration, I do think, doctors and clinicians fundamentally want to provide high-quality care to their patients. So how do you enable a system that supports that? And then the third and last point I'd call out is really just allowing people to innovate. Whether it's accountable care organizations or bundled payments, we try to outline the outcomes we want to achieve for patients, both quality and smarter spending, and then really let providers and communities and people innovate. If it's telehealth and bundled payment initiatives, or care managers or community health workers and accountable care organizations, we don't want to dictate the how, if you will. We want to let providers and people innovate on how they improve care.
Dr. Conway, I wanted to pull the thread a little more on both payments and care delivery. And you started off by saying that we're on the payment side moving from volume to value-based. And as the deputy administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, you are also looking at a number of care delivery models that aim to achieve sort of both of these ends of better integrated care and potentially better payment models. And we've heard over the years of accountable care organizations, PCMH, patient-centered medical homes, the SIMS, the state innovation models. So you've got all these experiments going on, right? And so one, we're trying to figure out how do those relate. And then you've got your new 962-page CMS proposed rule changes for payments. And you have clinicians who are going to choose sort of two different pathways, the merit-based incentive payment systems or the alternative payment models. How do I put together all of these?
So one, I think they are all connected with the high-level point of incentivizing, better care, smarter spending, and healthier people, and really moving our system to alternative payment models where the provider is accountable for quality and total cost of care for a population. That can be in an accountable care organization or a primary care medical home, could be for, in a bundled payment might be a 90-day episode around a hip and knee replacement, but they all have the high-level principle of increasing accountability for care coordination and better outcomes for patients. Accountable care organizations, we're seeing that grow. We've got about 9 million Medicare beneficiaries and ACOs, and last estimate I saw from the private sector is, over 27 million people in various ACOs across the country. And we are seeing improved quality, better patient experience, and lower cost. In bundled payments, which is one of the next big models, our voluntary bundled model has 48 various episodes like hip and knee replacements or cardiac surgery or medical conditions, and we've got over 1,500 hospitals, physician groups, and post-acute facilities volunteering to take on two-sided financial risk because they know they think they can improve quality and lower cost for a whole episode of care. At the end of the day, that's how patients think about it. Mm-hmm. If my mother has a hip and knee replacement, she wants better outcomes over that whole episode. And then lastly, with macro, with the proposed rule on the new physician payment system, physicians and clinicians will have choices on, the merit-based program, essentially paying for value, but adjusting based on quality and cost to really take on accountability for caring for their patients, preventing disease, and improving outcomes.
Well, Dr. Conway, when I think that the lofty goal of reducing fee-for-service payment for Medicare by 50% is a goal for the year 2018, which is already like on my calendar. So we've talked about alternative payment models, but when we think about alternative care models, the aging in place for our seniors, the more extensive use of telehealth, how does all of that figure into the equation with achieving the kind of changes that we want to see?
You know, the president and the secretary announced originally the 30% goal in alternative payment models by the end of 2016 and then 50% by 2018. A lot of people thought that was a stretch goal, maybe not achievable. And then we actually, you know, reached the 30% goal actually a year ahead of schedule. But now we're striving for that 50% goal by the end of 2018, as you mentioned. So, you know, we talked about a number of the payment models, telehealth. You know, we're increasingly, both in our accountable care organizations and our primary care medical homes, seeing doctors and care teams manage patients when and where and how patients want to interact with the health system, which is often at home through telehealth or remote monitoring or email or other technologies. You know, we have a model that is literally home-based primary care for very frail elderly patients, saved over $3,000 per beneficiary, like a person who had been hospitalized 19 times the year before and wasn't hospitalized at all in the year, you know, in this model. So really preventing those kind of hospitalizations and things that no one wants to go through. You know, the palliative care issues, our biggest model there is care choices, which, you know, you're either in hospice and you're forgoing curative care services or you're getting curative care, whereas most people, including, you know, my own father and patients I've taken care of, it's a much more trajectory that's not that black and white. And so we have a model that allows now patients to get hospice and palliative care services at the same time as so-called curative care services. So, you know, we think this is a much more patient-centered care model. And actually, evidence from the private market, it can improve quality and patient and family experience dramatically.
We're speaking today with Dr. Patrick Conway, Acting Principal Deputy Administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and CMS's Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality, as well as CMS's Chief Medical Officer. Dr. Conway is also responsible for all quality measures at CMS. And Dr. Conway, let's talk about those quality measures under your purview at the Centers for Clinical Standards and Quality, and yet another hat you wear, and you oversee quality measures and controls in all 50 states, ensuring that health providers are properly certified. As quality outcomes become more incentivized at CMS, how are you going to oversee those measures and to ensure, as you would say, that we're getting better care, healthier people, and the best outcomes?
So one, really focusing on outcome-oriented measures, you know, things like patient-reported outcomes after hip and knee surgery for functional status and how well a patient does, readmissions to the hospital, hospitalizations, to really being transparent about those results. So whether it's nursing homes or home health or in the physician setting, you know, publicly posting the results, often typically with star ratings that we've learned are more understandable for consumers. And then the last thing, you know, we do survey and certification in partnership with the states of, you know, nursing homes, hospitals, home health agencies, et cetera. You know, I unfortunately get reports every day of what we call immediate jeopardy, which are major quality and safety issues in a given provider. And there, you know, we work with the states to enforce those regulations, and including terminating providers from the programs. You got to go back to first principle, and our first principle is ensuring the quality and safety of the over 100 million. We're getting close to 140 million total beneficiaries if you add up Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, and Marketplace. So huge responsibility to try to ensure safety in all these healthcare settings for all Americans.
Well, Dr. Conway, it's no secret that providers are feeling just enormous pressure to embrace all of the changes that are out there to meet the benchmarks that we're setting. And they're also caught up in a tremendous amount of change. And I think we've read that you've even taken some heat from your own sister, who is a physician, about the concerns of many that you're just trying to do too much too fast. What are your thoughts on how we both maintain this culture of innovation and forward progress while not alienating and burning out the frontline clinicians delivering that care?
You know, we had heard from physicians and clinicians, you know, too rigid, not flexible, pointing and clicking instead of talking to patients. So, you know, we really tried to simplify, tried to make it much more flexible. still focus on interoperability and moving information around, but I think these principles around simplification, flexibility, less burden are critical. You know, you're right, I have a number of family members, and my sister's actually a solo practitioner. And I think, you know, these physicians and clinicians, they want to improve care, but they need support. So we launched this initiative we call the Transforming Clinical Practice Initiative, but we are funding over $650 million over 4 years and supporting these entities we call practice transformation networks. But they're basically, you know, entities that have relationships with physician and clinician practices. They now exist in every state across the country. And the whole point is to help these physicians and clinicians, you know, measure progress on quality. And it's peer-to-peer learning. This is critical. You know, this isn't me or CMS teaching a physician or clinician how to improve. This is, you know, peer-to-peer learning where one practice will teach another practice how to improve care. And there's good evidence that this kind of peer-to-peer learning is much more effective.
Well, I'd be interested to know if there are any transcripts of your Thanksgiving dinners with your sister and others. And we've been focusing much on the Medicare incentives, but recently CMS offered new guidelines for the Medicaid population. I think I've lost track of the numbers of folks in Medicaid, somewhere between 60 and 70 million people, but obviously it's grown significantly under the Affordable Care Act. And recently the Obama administration released new rules governing the Medicaid services to ensure the coverage they are being given meets specific guidelines. And I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about these new rules and how you anticipate they'll improve the experience.
Yeah, so Medicaid, as you said, growing substantially, and then, you know, nationally over two-thirds of Medicaid beneficiaries now receiving their benefits through Medicaid managed care. That finalization of that rule for Medicaid managed care was the first complete overhaul in over two decades, so really focusing on quality of care. So everything from quality rating systems to quality improvement focus. You know, two, it really does align with our care transformation goals. So, for example, incentivizing Medicaid managed care to pay providers based on accountability for populations. You know, it also includes provisions around appropriate networks of physicians and clinicians for Medicaid managed care. At the end of the day, it's all about aligning Medicaid requirements with commercial and Medicare whenever applicable, and really continuing to update and improve Medicaid and Medicaid managed care over time. And we want that care to be as high quality and the best possible outcomes as possible. So this Medicaid work as well aligns with the overall delivery system reform work that we talked about.
Well, Dr. Conway, you've covered a lot of ground here, and just so that our listeners have as good an understanding as they can, the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act has created such a buzz, and I understand your office is offering final rules this week. Can you talk about the new guidelines provided in MACRA, the acronym that you believe will promote more value-based models for care delivery?
Yeah, so we just put out the proposed rule, and we'll have 60 days for comments. It's the biggest change in physician and clinician payment probably in Medicare history, certainly in many, many decades. You know, number one, it takes a whole bunch of different quality and value systems that were created in different laws over time, and it puts them into one program. You know, two, it gives physicians and clinicians basically two paths. One is the so-called merit-based incentive. You know, we want you to improve quality. We want you to focus on resource use, how you use technology, and clinical practice improvement activities. And, you know, if you do well in those areas, we're going to adjust your payments up. We're going to pay you more for doing well. And, you know, we think we can do that in a way that aligns with what physicians and clinicians want for their patients and what patients obviously want in the care delivery system. And then the second pathway is these advanced alternative payment models, so things like some of our accountable care organizations or some of our primary care medical homes, where say, you know, if you're willing to really invest and take on accountability for these populations of patients, and, you know, there's a 5% bonus payment by law for those physicians and clinicians and groups of providers willing to do that. And we think that pathway will increase over time. You know, my mother's a Medicare beneficiary. She happens to receive care through an ACO. I think at the end of the day, I think her experience is not that different than many, where, You know, now her physician and clinician and special and various specialists and others, she luckily, you know, is quite healthy. You know, they're focused on coordinator care and making sure that, you know, she goes to the appropriate follow-up appointments, that her medications are managed, that and that's good. You know, that's what we want out of our care system for all the people in the system. So that's really the key focus of the new rules.
We've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Conway, Principal Deputy Administrator, Chief Medical Officer, and CMS Deputy Administrator for Innovation and Quality at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service. You can learn more about his work by going to cms.gov or following at CMS Innovates on Twitter. Dr. Conway, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
In late April 2014, the city of Flint began using the Flint River as its water source. But the Flint River has particularly corrosive water, which led to high levels of lead leaching into the water from many of the city's dated pipes. In July 2015, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services claimed the elevated blood lead levels in children followed a normal seasonal trend. The link between Flint's water switch and elevated blood lead levels in children wasn't confirmed until two independent researchers put forth their own analyses in September 2015. At an April U.S. House hearing, Representative Gene Green asked Nick Lyon, director of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, why the department had concluded that the spike in blood lead levels wasn't related to the water supply. Lyon said that the initial July 2015 department analysis showed seasonal fluctuations that were comparable to years before, but the analysis showed the opposite. The state analysis aimed to answer whether the July, August, and September 2014 blood lead levels in children under 16 fell within the normal seasonal range compared with previous years. But the state researcher concluded that only the 2014 summer months had elevated blood lead levels, quote, higher than that expected from random variation over time. It was more than 2 months after that July 2015 analysis that the County Health Department declared a public health emergency and told residents not to drink the water. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us, and then the counselor on the other side is not working from a phone. They're on a screen that almost looks kind of like Facebook or Gmail.
Nancy Lublin is founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So if you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red.
They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas to kids contemplating suicide. Those in most danger are encouraged to take action through a series of channels. Crisis Text Line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention, free of charge and 24/7. To give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.